Recorded live.
This is the Medicast Live, December 9th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have some very special guests here, and we're talking about a very special topic. It's a topic a lot of people get a little uncomfortable talking about, but we're going to learn so much about it tonight that it's going to raise our comfort level significantly. At least that's my hope. We're going to be talking about dealing with the stress that comes along with the job in EMS, as well as just everyday stress, because I think being better people at managing stress in our everyday lives will make it easier for us a little bit to deal with that critical incident stress when it comes up. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. I want to also announce to you all here that starting tonight, the MedicCast is now a member of the ProMed Network, promednetwork.com, and that's something I've been partnering with the folks over at Blueberry for some time. We finally got it up and running, and so you can check that out at your leisure. Lots of great professional medical podcasts available for you over at promednetwork.com, and we're proud to have that online and ready to go here at the end of 2008, and we'll talk more about that as the other podcasts come on in the coming weeks. So without further ado, let's go ahead and introduce our very special guests here tonight. First off, we wouldn't have EMS stress discussion without our next guest. CISM Perspectives, Dan McGuire, has been a longtime guest on Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal podcast. I look forward to hearing him on Rick's show when he's been on from time to time. And I'm very, very grateful that he was able to come in here late tonight and sit down and talk with us from his perspective to talk a little bit about critical incident stress management and stress management in general. So, Dan McGuire, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome, and it's indeed a pleasure to be able to help people understand just what critical incident stress is, and sometimes, more importantly, what it isn't, and also the mere fact that nobody out there, regardless of years of service or level of education, everybody is vulnerable to critical incident stress, and it's been my professional passion and career to help all emergency responders to realize that you can acknowledge that this stuff is real and that it is okay to get help when you need it most.
And we'll be talking some more about that later on. It's important for everybody to remember that what we talk about here on the show is something that we all deal with. And I know, Dan, you've had a saying that you've kind of started to coin of recent note about that particular topic, that it's not if you're going to have to deal with critical incident stress, but when. And what is it you say?
Well, there's a couple of them. They're called McGuire-isms here in Rochester, New York, where I'm known. And the latest one actually came out of a project when I was working with the Knoxville Police Department. And the motto that came out of that project was, let's get to it before it gets to them. And it is simply the critical incident stress and the hazards that come with that. So that's one of my new taglines. And the other tagline that we commonly use is, only the strongest are those who are willing to ask for help.
I think that that's a great way to come about it, Dan, is to talk a little bit about that, you know, the strength, because I think it takes a strong person. It takes a person who's got a strength of character to step forward and say, I need some help. It's easy for us because we're always the one helping other people to be the helper, but it's difficult for us to be the person on the receiving end of help sometimes. I think it goes against our deeper natures. Before we get too much farther into the discussion, I want to welcome some of our other great guests here tonight. First of all, Rick Rosati. Rick, we finally got you back on the Medicast Live. I know we've had some scheduling issues and you've had a lot of other things going on, but it's great to have you here.
Great to be here, Jamie, and thanks so much, Dan, for being able to jump on with the Medicast Live tonight.
Absolutely. Indeed, a pleasure to get the word out.
And we also have some other guests here that we'll bring up as we go along. We have Kenny from Colorado who's joining us. So we also have Kelly, who's going to be always chiming in with her experience on the West Coast. And we have some other folks. I'd like to give a special shout out to a friend of ours, a friend of the Medicast, Emma. She's joining us for the first time here on the Medicast. She's a student who's aspiring to become an EMS provider. And she's been sending me lots of links and information and asking lots of the right questions. So Emma, we want to welcome you here to this forum and, you know, ask away, because this is a difficult topic, but it's something that if you want to be an EMS provider, you're going to need to understand. And so it's a great opportunity for you to get in on the ground floor. Okay, Dan, I'm going to start off with you, and I really want to ask the question here. What is critical incident stress, and how does it directly relate to the EMS provider? And because you say it's not a question of if, but when. So clearly, all of us are going to come across something that's going to trip that switch. Is it an individual thing? Is it a question of quantity? Is mass casualty incident going to cause critical incident stress? What causes those kind of problems?
Well, all excellent questions. It's an amazing fact to look at that. I do so many new EMT lectures, and I tell them right up front that it may not be your very first call, or it may be your 100th call, that an event is going to, that you're going to participate in as a medic, and something within that event, we refer to them as the imprints of horror, whether it was a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, how something physically felt, that is going to exceed your normal levels of past experiences. And this is the true definition of critical incident stress. This is we've all faced a number of horrors as we respond as fire, EMS, and police. And 30 years in EMS, I can't even say that I've seen it all, but I have certainly seen my share. But the true definition of critical incident stress is an event that exceeds our past normal experiences. So if you've never done CPR for the at all, the first time you do that thrust down and it feels like you're breaking bones, that sound and that feel will stay with you for quite some time. Some of the horrors that we actually have to witness, a person bleeding out, a mass casualty incident, and it doesn't take a mass casualty incident to create a critical incident. Again, it could be just something within that incident that you see, hear, smell, taste, whatever that imprint might be, that just simply pushes that button, and that's the call that sticks with you. That's the call that keeps you up at night. That's the call that in a couple of days, maybe even just a couple hours afterwards, you might start saying, why am I doing this? I didn't sign up to see dead kids. I didn't sign up to see an entire family murdered by some drug addict. It's when our both physical and psychological responses to an incident are pushed to a level, pushed to a point that it is not something that we've normally dealt with before. In other words, that cup is overflowing with the sight, sound, smells, and this starts literally what we call the cascade of the critical incident stress. And everybody needs to recognize and validate that critical incident stress is physically seen, and we also see it in the mind. So we have to realize that, yes, there's physical things that we've got to fix, but there's also the psychological things within the responder's mind, body, and soul that need to be fixed. And that's where a lot of us are very, very hesitant. Wait a minute, I'm supposed to be the responder. I'm supposed to be the person with all the answers. And when I can't solve this person's problem, that goes to a depth that people just aren't comfortable with when you're an emergency responder's role.
So there's a question that's coming up in the chat room here, and a couple of people are echoing it. How does critical incident stress for the responder, the first responder here in the U.S., how does that relate to something like the PTSD issues we're seeing coming from the military members that are coming home? Is there a similarity? How do they relate together?
There is a great amount of similarity, but I want to make sure everybody on tonight's program understands that critical incident stress does not equal PTSD. And I actually do a lot of lectures on PTSD awareness for EMS responders. And I've had some personal experiences with PTSD as well. And we have to be really careful that we don't use those words interchangeably, where PTSD does not equal critical incident stress and vice versa. Now, can critical incident stress over time lead to PTSD? Absolutely. But we have to remember that PTSD is a diagnosable mental health disease, very treatable. It is not a badge of shame to recognize that you may have PTSD, and the same thing with critical incident stress. They both affect us, what I call the mind, body, soul. It's going to affect the way we think, the way we act, the way we interact with our patients, with our partner, with our families. It's going to affect our physical well-being. Not many people realize that the number one body system that is the most affected by critical incident stress is our immune system. Our immune system has the largest target on it from poorly managed critical incident stress. And so that can lead to a number of cascade of physical ailments. And then there's that soul piece, not necessarily a religious side, but I think everybody at one point in their career or another, especially with September 11th, I remember asking the question, how could my God let something like this happen? And we can really start questioning our faith. And a lot of people in EMS are very faith-based, and that's one of their coping mechanisms and coping skills. And when we see such a horrific sight and hear the horrific sound that comes from that event and all the other imprints, absolutely we can start questioning, am I doing this for the right reasons? It can really shake the foundations of our own self-esteem and self-confidence. As well, it can shake the foundations of our religious beliefs. And those are all very similar things that we see when somebody is diagnosed with PTSD. In fact, a very big headline was in the USA Today last November, a year ago, that PTSD is the number two injury coming out of Afghanistan or in Iraq. And this is a groundbreaking acknowledgement from our military that PTSD is a issue that they have to do a much better job on dealing with. So a short answer to your question, PTSD and critical incident stress do have familiar signs and symptoms, but I really want to make sure people understand that those two words are not interchangeable by any means.
Well, that's good to know. And I heard you mention a couple of things, and I'm going to ask you to expand on them a little bit, because they relate back to a critical incident that I dealt with early, back when I was an EMTB, having to do, you talked about imprints, and you've been talking a couple of different times about different sensations, sight, smell, sound. And for me, I dealt with a very seriously burned patient, third-degree burns over 85-90% of their body, and yet they were conscious and talking in significant pain, but talking to me. And the smell of that burned person stuck with me for weeks. I was gun-shy of getting on the ambulance. I It's like I couldn't blow my nose enough to get the smell of this guy out. And you know, absolutely, it wasn't like it was still there, but it was in my mind. It was like you said, imprints. And so can you expand a little bit more on how it's the sensations? It's sometimes not just what we see, but it's some of the other sensations that stick with us longer.
Absolutely. And what I referred to is those imprints of horror. And we have to realize that when we respond to emergency calls, our mind and body goes into what I call the autopilot mode, where our training and our past experiences kick in, and we literally can do the job that we have to do regardless of what's facing us, whether it's, you know, blood, broken bones, dead bodies, whatever it might be. I had a similar experience like yours with burnt flesh, and that's a smell that just doesn't go away very soon. But while we're in this autopilot mode, what we don't realize is our psyche is actually working very, very hard in pulling in this data, because we all have the five senses, you know, sight, sound, smell, hearing, and taste. And while we're in this autopilot mode and literally just doing our work, whether it's intubation, dropping a line, whatever it might be, we can do that with our eyes closed because we're well-trained and we've done it a number of times. And even though we're in that autopilot mode, we don't realize that our psyche, our brain is actually still collecting data from those five senses, and it's actually storing it within a portion of the brain structure. And once we get out of that autopilot mode, and that's typically maybe we're filling out our patient care report, we're restocking the rig, or maybe we're just off shift and we're just driving into the driveway, or we might be brushing our teeth at night, and all of a sudden something triggers one of those imprints. It might be the sound of something, the sight of something, the smell of something, and boom, we are back at that scene, and we can literally relive it. We are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting it, and that is actually part of the psyche's process to help us to actually download and to help get rid of some of these imprints that the psyche has stored. And that's what we call, in fact, it's an area that is very, very delicate. It's what we call the letdown phase. That's when, again, things are quiet. Maybe you're off shift and you've had a chance to start thinking about what you just heard, smelled, felt, and experienced. And it's this letdown phase. Again, autopilot is off, and now we're just sort of allowing our mind to float a little bit and process this event. That's where we start the questioning. Why is this bothering me now? It's been 2 days or 6 hours, or that happened yesterday. Why all of a sudden am I being exposed to these sights, sounds, and smells? And that's where the people, the responders, typically start doubting what's wrong with me. Everybody else is fine after that call, but why am I the only one that's having difficulties now? And that's what can really create a lot of issues within that responder's mind, that there's something wrong. I'm the weak link in the chain because my partner is fine the next morning, but I can't get that sight. I can't get that sound out of my head. Every time I close my eyes, I can see everything clearly. And that is that real critical point in the psyche's process of allowing it to download and rid of this data that's taken in. And when that hits us unexpectedly, that can really throw any medic, whether you're on the job for 10 minutes or 10 years, that can throw any good responder off their baseline, and they start thinking, wait a minute, there's something wrong with me, and I don't dare tell anybody that I'm having these thoughts and fears and reactions, because what might they think of me if I'm talking about the stuff a day or two later?
There's a question in the chat room asking about critical incident stress debriefings, and I guess it's time to really move into some of the process of managing critical incident stress, because I think some of the things you're mentioning here is that, first of all, it's very personal.
Absolutely. And so
what affects you may not affect your partner and vice versa. So when a debriefing may not be needed for everyone on a call, how does that process work into beginning to manage critical incident stress?
That's exactly the big question we get all the time. You know, if 10 people go to a fatal car accident and only one person comes, one person is affected by that, does the entire group need to be sequestered, if you will, and made to go to a debriefing or defusing? Absolutely not. That's not what CISM is about. And there's another tagline that I like to use to help people to understand the CISM process is, and this is a very important thing for all the listeners to really digest and to understand, is CISM is to psychology as first aid is to surgery. People have to realize the critical incident stress management model, where we use diffusing, debriefings, one-on-ones, and so forth, that is psychological first aid. We are not there to be psychologists or anything like that. It is based on peer support. It's based on a like group of people who have gone through a incident as a group, and as a group, we are going to process that event, validate and normalize everybody's different actions and reactions to that event, and make sure everybody realizes that I'm not the only one feeling this way, that it's okay not to feel okay. And when you hear that type of validation from your peers, especially if you're a newer guy on the job and you're hearing one of the senior guys saying, yeah, you know, this is a call that's going to stick with me, and hearing them showing some vulnerability, that can move mountains out of the way for that critical incident stress to be properly processed and to help that person move forward. Because we have to remember, after any type of trauma, and I'm also a certified grief counselor, and we use a same information, is moving on doesn't mean that you're forgetting. Moving on is very much the healthy part of that psychological processing and healing. So that's why not everybody will need a diffusing or debriefing, and that's okay. And the team that I'm part of here in Rochester, New York, we do a lot of one-on-one requests where, 10 people went to that fatal car accident, and maybe it was a seasoned group of people, but maybe there's a brand new EMT or a brand new driver on that rig, and that's a first time that they had to experience a fatality. And that's the person that we want to make sure that gets the help. And if the other folks are doing fine and they're using good, healthy coping mechanisms and coping skills, then there's no reason to make them go to that debriefing or diffusing. There's another tagline that I tend to use when we do set up debriefings, that you may be okay, and that's fine. It looks like you're processing this event. So if you don't think you need to go to that debriefing for yourself, why don't you go anyways and support your peers who are there, and so they can see that they're not the only person that may have been affected by this incident.
There's been some questions raised, and it's something that I think we all probably, especially if we've been around for a while, have dealt with, is the joking around after a tough call. I know there's been a lot of discussions talking about gallows humor and how, you know, I've never met anybody with as sick a sense of humor as a group of paramedics and firefighters after a particularly rough rescue call. And so the question has come up, you know, when you're back at the station and you're all joking around and, you know, seeing who can be the next sickest guy about what we just all saw. How do you ask for help in that kind of a situation? And the question came up, how do you ask for help without asking for help?
That's the $1,000 question. And I agree with you. There is not a more twisted group of people than firefighters and EMTs after a call and using the gallows humor. And that's encouraged. Now, that's actually another form of peer support. In fact, I have a sister who's been an RN in the emergency room for almost 30 years, and she and I always have a contest at the Thanksgiving dinner table to see who can gross out the family the quickest by using gallows humor. So it's certainly a healthy part, but we also have to make sure that when we're using that gallows humor, that we're doing it with the right audience. It probably shouldn't be at the hospital where family members might hear it, or somebody who just doesn't know what's happened might have a very different opinion about us than and not understand why we use gallows humor on that. But that's something we actually encourage, and that's just keeping those communications lines open between those people who were directly involved in that event. And something else that we really are trying to educate the responders on, sometimes the best CISM happens in the back of that ambulance on the way back from the call by just talking to your peers about that event and, hey, guys, you know, I can't seem to get this out of my mind, this particular incident. And if you can open the lines that way and get the other folks in the back of the ambulance just to talk normally about the event and just start processing it, that can be the best CISM, better than what any trained CISM responder can supply. So it is appropriate for gallows humor, but it also goes back to how does the agency as a whole view CISM, and do they have any type of in-house peer support trained members? Do they even know about the external resources like the teams that are in many, many cities? If the agency isn't pro-CISM, that's going to even squelch further that one or two people who are looking to get some help. If they see that the peer pressure coming from the agency who doesn't believe in this, they're going to clam up even more, and that's going to end up just burning inside them even deeper. So it's on an individual level as well as an agency level of how do we get the help out to the right people? And that's where the leadership need to step up to the plate and verbally state that, whether it's in a meeting or a drill, folks, we are, our concern is to make sure that our own people, when you go home, you're not taking more baggage home with you than you came with. The other thing is that leadership respects that person's request that, you know what, I having some difficulties with this call, and I would like to be able to talk to a trained person. And if they get the feedback from that leadership, well, we don't believe in that, and here, just, you know, I'll call Dr. Jack Daniels, and I'm sure he'll help you out, or the classic suck it up and take it like a man, that's going to really do a particularly damage, especially to those new responders who are trying to model after their senior peers that they're working with.
Yeah, that's a huge issue, and I was heartened by your statement earlier that the military is recognizing PTSD as a battle injury, because it just goes back to the need that we need to we really need to recognize that just because it's not as visible and easily palpated as a broken arm doesn't mean that a psychological injury isn't just that it is an actual injury. So I'm heartened to hear that, you know, that kind of recognition is going on in such a major official organization. It's just hopefully, like so many things, trickle down to us from the military. I guess this will hopefully maybe make its way down faster. I'm going to bring Rick in here because I'm sure he has some comments to throw in and you know, to share, especially from the aspect of an agency response. And I know that Rick's a firm believer in dealing and handling critical incident stress quickly and effectively. But I also know, Rick, you've talked to a lot of people and responders from other places and gotten, you know, responses from your listeners on these topics. How do you feel? Do you feel that critical incident stress management is really a cultural issue inside of an organization?
Jamie, I agree with you 100%. It's all about the culture inside your ambulance base or inside your firehouse. And the way to describe that best is it starts at the top. It starts with the leadership of any organization as to whether or not they have buy-in into the into the process. And so many folks still have that armor mentality, that image armor that Dan talks so much about, that prevent them from admitting that we do have problems in our workplaces. And by workplaces, I mean where you volunteer or where you get your paycheck. One thing that I have noticed about emergency responders in the last 10 years or so, and mostly due to my conversations with Dan, has been to bring to the coffee table, so to speak, the fact that we're not only dealing with workplace stress, but each one of us has lifestyle stress and lifestyle problems that we have to deal with just like every other human being. And sometimes that is just an item that tips the scale or makes it more difficult to deal with those workplace issues. And it's that cumulative stress that's just built up over so many years that puts us on that precipice or that edge when we come to work, and really sets us up for failure sometimes if we don't choose as organizational leaders to support our people to engage in proactive critical incident stress management before it gets to us.
You know, I see some discussion in the chat room about, you know, the opposite of what we just talked about, Rick, is forcing people to go through CISM, even if they don't need it. And I see Dan has chimed in the chat room that you shouldn't be forcing people to deal with a critical incident before they're ready to deal with it. I'm sure you believe that firmly. You need to let people be prepared for it. Is that correct, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I teach a number of level of CISM classes, the basic, the advanced, and have helped set up numerous teams across the country. And in the old days, when people have to realize CISM is not that old. It really wasn't formally put together, introduced, and actually launched until the mid to late 1980s. So it's still in its infancy, in my mind, compared to other things that are in emergency responders out there. And in the earlier days, it was almost suggested that try to make it mandatory because of that whole image armor issue that's out there. Because nobody wants to show their skirt when they're out there in the field. Nobody wants to really show how they're feeling because of that whole John Wayne persona that is so present in emergency services. And there's a newer focus, and I guess I'm taking it as both a personal and professional passion, is there's been some significant changes since September 11th on the approach to CISM. And it focuses around if somebody is not ready for it, right, for a debriefing or diffusing, that's okay. One of the key things that we learned from the September 11th response is it's not always a matter of time that has elapsed that we should be applying the diffusings and debriefings. The general guideline with diffusings is you try to hold that diffusing anywhere from 2 to 6 hours within the close of the incident, or at least the close of the day of that incident. And the debriefing is typically we recognize that's best if you can offer that anywhere from 24 to 72 hours after the incident closes. And we're moving away from that a little bit more. And one of the inventors of CISM, George Everly out of Baltimore, wrote a very powerful self-effacing article right after September 11th acknowledging that, you know, we may not have done things quite correctly at Ground Zero or at Washington or in Pennsylvania. And we have come full circle on that and realizing it's more of the psychological readiness of the individual or the group. That's sort of the key factor of when to apply the debrief and diffusing. Instead of being so rigid on this 2 to 6 hours or 24 to 72 hours. So instead of looking at how many hours have passed, let's look closer at the group and an individual, their psychological readiness for them to accept that type of help. And the other big push that we're trying to get people to understand and to sort of take the sting out of CISM or the misconceptions is we're really trying to train teams out there to teach people resiliency. How do we get to people before it gets to them, like we talked about earlier? And that's one of the most important parts of a successful CISM program is that pre-education piece. If I could have my way, every EMT, every firefighter, every law enforcement officer would have at least a three-hour in-service lecture on what is critical incident stress, how is it going to look, feel, and taste when you're out there, how can you best manage it on a personal level, as well on an agency level. And we're really trying to push that even stronger than we had before. And it goes back to that pre-incident training. How do we get to it before it gets to them? And I equal it to like being a flu shot. You should have a flu shot well before the flu season. If you don't, the effects of that flu are going to be a whole lot worse than if you didn't have the flu shot. So we're using that same type of analogy. And the other thing that we're trying to do is we're all born and grow up through adulthood learning coping mechanisms, coping skills of how to deal with trauma, loss, and grief as we go through life. And I refer to it as our toolbox. And each of us have a different toolbox with us every day when we're out there in the field. And everybody has a different number of tools in their toolbox, and the sizes are different, and the depth of those tools are different. And one of our newer goals with CISM, as well as teaching resiliency and doing the pre-education, the other thing is to reconnect that responder to what they already have on board, and quite often reconnecting them to their own coping and mechanisms and coping skills is a very powerful piece that person realizes that I do have the ability to handle this event and to be able to process it in a healthy manner. And if I still need some help after that, then I know where to go get that. And there's a third piece that we're trying to do a better job on teaching is normalizing and validating. Normalizing that your reactions are the normal piece. It was the critical incident that you experienced was the abnormal piece. That's an important thing responders need to understand, and especially leadership to buy in, is normal responders having normal reactions to an event that was abnormal, and then also validating that, you know, if you're having sleepless nights or that call is still sticking inside your image armor, even after a couple of days, that it's okay. Because I probably had a similar experience, and I went through the same type of processes you did. So, again, we're trying to teach and role model resiliency, reconnecting them to what they already have in their toolbox of survivor skills, and then normalizing and validating those responders' individual reactions to that event. And one other piece I'll throw in is the word thrive versus survive. All of us can survive a critical incident and just slog through the day, slog through life, and not process that event. And one of the new things that I'm trying to educate people on and push is I want you to be a thriver from that event, not just a survivor. Because as a thriver, you can pull out of that critical incident a growing opportunity, a learning opportunity, and that's going to make you a better person, it's going to make you a better medic, and it's going to make you a healthier person, mind, body, and soul.
Dan, you know, the question came up in the chat room that, you know, when you don't feel comfortable telling other people about your feelings, how comfortable is someone else going to be to share those feelings with you? Is dealing with this really something that requires a facilitator to start that discussion, or is this something that you, as a partner who cares about the people you work with, can start recognizing signs of critical incident stress, remembering that there was a potentially bad call recently, and opening that door yourself.
Well, that goes right back to my earlier statement, and this is something I really believe strongly in and really push in lectures and teachings, and anybody who will listen to me for more than 5 minutes, is that the best CISM is that peer-to-peer support. Maybe you're in the EMS room at the hospital filling out the forms and so forth, and your partner can see something in you that doesn't look like you normally do. And just by that person reaching out at a peer level and saying, hey, Dan, it looks like that call really got to you. Is there something that I can help you with? Can I just listen and just start that? That often is the best tool anybody can use. But if it's in a group setting and if somebody is not comfortable talking in the group setting, then that really falls onto the facilitator. And one of the very, very strong ground rules that I push at all times is if you are going to attend a diffusing or debriefing, it's completely voluntary participation. I can't even spell the word mandatory. At no time should this be made mandatory and forced upon anybody, because then you are going to create damage and you're going to create hostility towards the facilitator and towards the program. We encourage people, if you want to just sit and listen and not have to say anything, that's fine. But we do encourage people, if you do feel comfortable in talking about that event is very therapeutic. It starts that cathartic process. It helps you taking scrambled thoughts and fleeting thoughts going through your mind, and by putting them into words helps you give it a little bit more of a concrete essence, and that the words are now out on the table and other people can say, hey, yeah, you know what? I felt that same way after this call, and I had a call just like this a year ago, and I had the same type of reactions that you did. And that starts that validation that's so important, that normalizing. So that facilitator of that diffusing debriefing really needs to set those ground rules clearly, that this is a voluntary participation. We're not going to force you to talk, but we want to encourage you, if there's something that you want to comment on or just to share how that event affected you, please do so, because it's like trying to put a puzzle back together. Our psyche needs complete pieces to put together these type of incidents so the psyche can process that event. And if we're missing pieces of that, we're not going to be able to process that event completely, and that's going to probably stick with us. By hearing other people's version of that story and being able to fill in some of the blank spots, that can really facilitate and accelerate that person's psyche's ability to process that event, normalize the event, normalize that individual's reactions, and most likely that call is not going to stick with them for the rest of their lives.
That's going to wrap up part one, the first half of this episode from the Medicast Live on EMS critical incident stress, chronic stress, and dealing with those issues. I will urge you to come back and check out next week's episode with part two. We'll be talking about recognizing stress in yourself and others, as well as particular issues in chronic stress and dealing with some of the problems when companies deal with providers as disposable resources, just like any other disposable item on the ambulance. So all of that will be coming up next week. I want to thank Dan McGuire again for his generous help in putting this episode and next week's episode together. And again, urge you to check out the amazing resources he has available over at CISMperspectives.com. You'll find a lot of good stuff there, as well as access to how you can bring him in to talk to your service about critical incident stress, about setting up good CISM programs in your agency and surrounding community. All of that's available from Dan's site, so I want to make sure you check all of that out. I also want to thank our other guests, Rick Rosati, and some of the other folks that you will be hearing in the second half of this segment. It's still holiday time, so I will be closing out, as I always do, with some good holiday music for this time of year. And this is going to be a song, if you've been listening in years past, you've probably heard me play this. It's one of my favorite Christmas songs, a rock number of Do You Hear What I Hear from an artist by the name of Jill Parr. There'll be a link in the show notes. So if you like what you hear, you can head over and check out her music or purchase it from iTunes, all available for you at the Medicast show notes for this episode. So check it out, and if you like what you hear, let Jill know you heard it here on the Medic Cast. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Don't forget to come back next week for the second half of this great episode. And in the meantime, remember, scene safety, BSI. Okay.